Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
The Economist.
Hello, and welcome to The Intelligence from The Economist. I'm Ora Ogunbiyi.
And I'm Jason Palmer. Every weekday, we provide a fresh perspective on the events shaping your world.
An obscure communist newspaper in Japan is punching well above its weight, landing big scoops and reporting on the kinds of political scandals that no one else would dare to. What does it say about the rest of the country's media?
And the word lonely has pretty poor connotations, connecting it to bad emotions and even bad health outcomes. But our correspondent trawls through some new literature that reveals the nuanced upsides of being alone. First up, though. This morning, more signs of unrest at American universities. At the University of California, Los Angeles, clashes broke out between pro-Israeli and pro-Palestinian demonstrators. Protests have been spreading across the country, exposing what have become familiar fault lines. What counts as protected free speech and what doesn't? What power universities have to enforce their rules when students test them? And the fine line between collective security and individual rights? These aren't, as it were, academic questions. People are being suspended, expelled, arrested. It's happened in North Carolina, Texas, Florida. What's most dramatic is what happened overnight at Columbia University in New York City. Students took over Hamilton Hall and barricaded the entrance. They said they wouldn't move until their demands were met, that is, for the university to divest from Israel. Our reporter, Rosemary Ward, who herself attended Columbia as a graduate student, was on the scene.
I had been there all afternoon. Only a handful of media were allowed on campus. The rest of us were standing at the gates. And after a while, the protesters on campus came to us to chat and to chant and to talk and to give speeches. And as the day went on, more and more protesters on the outside of the gate started to arrive. And as it got darker, even more arrived, and more police arrived. And then they shut down the streets, and then barricades arrived, and then more cops arrived. Broadway was like a militarized zone. The tension just kept building and building. And it all came to a head.
This is the New York City Police Department. You have been warned as pursuit.
All of a sudden, I hear this voice.
If you refuse to leave, you may be placed under arrest.
The automated voice telling the crowd to disperse.
You have been warned as per City College.
And as it got closer, a lot of the protesters at the gate started running. And I started running. And from there, it just got surreal. Hundreds of police in riot gear started walking up Amsterdam. And some of the younger protesters next to me who were students started getting really upset, saying, you know, they're just kids. And then all of a sudden they started arresting some of the protesters who were standing by the gate. And then I never saw a vehicle like this. It was like a mixture of a tank, a fire truck, and it had this weird ladder on the top, and there was cops sitting on the top and inside it.
Wow. What the hell?
What is that?
And it drove past us and then turned into the building. At first it looked like it was going to actually ram the building, but then this ladder extended onto the second floor window, and some of the cops jimmied open the window.
What are they trying to do?
And one by one, they started to go in. You could see the lights of Hamilton one by one going on as the police started to search. You could hear banging. And then occasionally we would see some cops coming out with protesters. Fairly quickly, they filled several buses with protesters. And as they filled them and drove by us, the protesters outside were cheering them and trying to give them support. And it was so surreal.
The raid last night was shocking and without precedent in recent decades at Columbia or really any other major American university.
Steve Call is a visiting senior editor at The Economist and a former dean of Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism.
I was there a couple of weeks ago, just before the first police raid, and though I had taught at Columbia for the last 10 years, I had never seen such a divisive and tense atmosphere. This has only gotten worse since I visited, and the scenes last night, though they might be familiar to people who are at Columbia in 1968, the last time there was such police action on campus, to many students, professors, administrators, this is a scene none of them would have imagined.
But ultimately, what this is about is the question of what can be said at universities and what fits into the wide perception of what's free speech. Why is that so thorny?
Well, because universities occupy a distinctive ground in the American First Amendment regime. They neither allow speech as permissively at private universities as the First Amendment does, because the First Amendment allows all kinds of speech, false, outrageous, hateful. Anything short of targeted direct incitement to violence is protected under American jurisprudence. A university can't function with a classroom full of such speech, so it seeks a balance that privileges speech more than, say, a workplace would, but also tries to regulate it. Now, in recent years, universities have largely succeeded in striking that balance. When unpopular speakers come to the university, they're given a platform and protesters are given space, but it's not permitted to disrupt another speaker with your own speech. Where universities have struggled and what was exposed by the Gaza protests is on the subject of targeted hate speech. That had no real precedent, even in the most controversial cases of unpopular speakers over the last few years. But to have students engaged in what might be constitutionally protected speech, such as waving signs or chanting "Globalize the Intifada," while some of the 5,000 Jewish students at Columbia tried to attend their classes, that presented a dilemma that the university was simply unprepared to manage.
And so in that regard, how do you rate the university administrator's response to this particular, this pointed question?
I think they were paralyzed. I think they discovered that they lacked the tools to deal with that. They had allowed this environment of partially regulated speech to drift since October 7th without really confronting the pattern of targeted speech that might not be anti-Semitic on its face, but was highly uncomfortable for the many Jewish students at Columbia. They tended to focus on the rules they could easily enforce, the black letter rules like trespass and setting up improper encampments, things that it violated policies that were well established. But by doing that, they failed to address the principal complaint of thousands of Jewish students and their supporters outside. And that led to the politicization of events at Columbia, where members of Congress decided to take it upon themselves to tell the university administration exactly what it should do.
But the question here is not which statute you choose to pursue, but how this has been pursued. The question of sending in police in riot gear to boot these students out.
Exactly. And the best solution is obviously not to have the police come in wearing riot gear. The best solution was always to try to negotiate for the voluntary dismantlement of these encampments in exchange for the university negotiating seriously about the students' demands. In fact, that solution has been achieved at Brown University, at Northwestern. At Columbia, the decision was made early to bring the police in to clear out the encampment, and that backfired. It generated a backlash, and new encampments immediately sprung up, almost redoubling the problem. So last night, when the police were brought in, it followed an escalation by the students who occupied a building, broke windows, and threatened never to leave. So in a sense, the original sin was the first decision to bring in the police before an attempt at negotiating an internal settlement had been made.
Exactly. And the problem, as you mentioned, is far wider than just Columbia. We spoke last week on the show about the potential political implications of all of these protests. Do you think this will have political weight into the future?
It already has substantial political weight. I think students have already demonstrated their alienation from the Biden administration by the very protests they're mounting, many of which are directed against Biden's policy in support of Israel. And now we have a direct echo of 1968 at Columbia University, where on April 30th, 1968, hundreds of students were arrested by New York police in very similar circumstances. They were protesting the Vietnam War primarily, of course. And what that previewed was a Democratic presidential nominating convention the following summer in Chicago, which became one of the most notorious events in American election history when Chicago police beat and arrested anti-war protesters.
And do you think the protesters now, the students who are part of all of this, feel that weight of history, feel that they're part of a historical narrative now in that same way?
I think clearly they do. That's part of why they've been escalating. It's hard to discern why the suffering in Gaza, which has angered and agitated so many people around the world in recent months, has had this intense salience with American college students more than climate, more than other issues that have been present on campus. It has mobilized young American students, and they are clearly now on fire. And with these police actions and administrative crackdowns, they're clearly, I think, going to carry this campaign well into the summer and toward the election in November. What impact it has on the final vote, harder to predict, but it's going to be a hot summer.
Steve, thanks very much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Hi, this is Janice Torres from Yo Quiero Dinero. From a local business to a global corporation, partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful, you'll make every move matter. Visit bankofamerica.com/bankingforbusiness to learn more. What would you like the power to do? Bank of America N.A. Copyright 2024.
Since Japan's parliamentary session began 3 months ago, one issue has dominated its agenda. A financial scandal within the ruling Liberal Democratic Party, or the LDP. At the end of last year, prosecutors launched an investigation into factions of the LDP, which had failed to report revenue from fundraising events, thereby evading taxes.
The Liberal Democratic Party's most powerful faction that is at the centre of a criminal investigation into...
Several people linked to the party have been indicted. In December, 4 cabinet ministers and 5 vice ministers were sacked. The Prime Minister, Kishida Fumio, whose approval rating hits a record low because of the scandal, has apologized and pledged reforms.
そして政治不信を引き起こしていることに対しまして、自民党総裁として。
He asked two party heavyweights to quit and punished 37 other party members. What might surprise you about all this is that this political turmoil can all be traced back to one seemingly insignificant newspaper.
Shimbun Akahata, or Red Flag Newspaper, is a relatively niche newspaper run by the Japan Communist Party, or the JCP.
Moika Ida writes about Japan for The Economist.
The paper is read by 850,000 subscribers, which is much lower compared to its peak of around 3.5 million in 1980. It was actually Shimbun Akahata who first reported on the LDP's funding discrepancies in 2022.So Akahata may be obscure, but it has proved to have a lot of influence.
Tell me a bit more about that.
I went to visit Shimbun Akahata's office in Sendagaya in Tokyo. There I spoke with Sasagawa Kamiyu, the 33-year-old journalist who first reported on the scoop. Mr. Sasagawa said he didn't expect things would blow up the way they did.I also asked him how he first reported on the story, and he was kind enough to walk me through the process. Mr. Sasagawa said he first reported on the scoop after scrutinizing government documents. He showed me some of those documents. He also collaborated with Kamiwaki Hiroshi, a law professor at Kobe Gakuen University,who helped elevate awareness of the issue by filing a criminal complaint with prosecutors.
Okay, this is some scoop for such a small publication.
Yes, and it's not the only example Akahata has reported on such a big scoop. Akahata has consistently punched above its weight. In 2013, it led an investigation into black kigyo or black companies,And they basically shed light on the prevalence of abusive workplaces in Japan and even pushed the government to introduce tighter regulation. Another big accomplishment by Akahata is the Cherry Blossom Viewing Party scandal in 2019. Back then, the newspaper reported on how politicians are subsidizing dinners for supporters during an annual Cherry Blossom Viewing Party. The scandal was a big blow to Abe Shinzo's career, the prime minister at the time.He wasn't charged, but he was questioned by prosecutors. And the scandal continued to haunt Abe until his resignation in August 2020 and even after that.
So what's the background to the paper? Why is it able to punch so far above its weight?
Well, to find out more about Akahata's history, I spoke to the paper's chief editor, Kogi Soyoji.
1922年に日本共産党が創立されるんですが、
He told me Akahata was founded in 1928, 6 years after the Japanese Communist Party, or the JCP, was established. At the time, the Communist Party was banned by Japan's militarist regime because they found communist ideas like opposing the imperial system too subversive. So Akahata was produced and circulated underground. Mr. Kogiso told me that police even arrested and tortured people reading Akahata. And after the Second World War, Japan was occupied by America. And ironically, despite America's own hostility towards communism, they legalized the JCP because it claimed to promote democracy and free speech. Mr. Kogiso said that he believes the paper's turbulent history contributes to its strong will to stand up against power.
Does it say something about the media landscape in Japan that such a niche publication has been the first to report on multiple political scandals?
Yes, I do think Akahata's accomplishments point to an awkward truth about the media landscape in Japan. So traditional media is very influential in Japan, partly because of its old demographic. So for instance, Yomiuri and Asahi, two of Japan's national newspapers, have some of the largest circulations in the world.They published 6.8 and 4 million copies a day, respectively. But oftentimes, these big publications fail to hold politicians to account. There seems to be a lot of self-censorship going on in mainstream publications, and that's because journalists often develop very close ties with authorities. And of course, this kind of access journalism is an issue in many places. Sources matter to journalists almost anywhere. But in the case of Japan, it's institutionalized in the form of press clubs, which assign journalists from mainstream papers to each government organization. And that makes it hard for journalists from these big publications to say anything to upset the government. According to Reporters Without Borders, a Paris-based NGO, Japan's freedom of press ranking slipped from 11th in 2010 to 68th in 2023. Before I spoke with Akahata, I was thinking, how do they manage to come up with these scoops and what kind of exclusive access to information do they have? But actually, Mr. Kogiso, the paper's editor, said Akahata's stories usually come from publicly available information. Going back to the cherry blossom viewing scandal, Mr. Kogiso mentioned that journalists from the big newspapers were actually invited to and attended Prime Minister Abe's cherry blossom parties each year. But there, they failed to notice that something might be wrong, that the Prime Minister might be violating public funding rules. So he says, usually the big media outlets already know what we know, but we just have a different perspective on things.
Marika, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's William Shakespeare, that great coiner of new words and phrases, who is usually given credit for the adjective lonely.
Henry Hitchens writes about culture for The Economist.
The Roman general Coriolanus, one of Shakespeare's heroes, likens heading into exile to a lonely dragon retreating to his lair. He had in mind a physical state, someone who was lonely, was simply alone. A big shift occurred around 1800 when, thanks to the Romantic poets, the word took on strong emotional overtones and people started to consider loneliness a condition of the soul. So, for instance, you have William Wordsworth. Famously, he writes of how he wandered lonely as a cloud. Loneliness is something that has lodged inside him. And it's possible for him to have this feeling even when there are people around him. By the early 20th century, loneliness was considered one of the defining afflictions of urban life. The philosopher Hannah Arendt lamented that a feeling that was once a borderline experience, usually suffered in certain marginal social conditions like old age, has become an everyday experience of the ever-growing masses. It's become common to say that the world is ever more connected, but loneliness is everywhere. Smartphones, social media, and online dating can do a lot to deepen feelings of insularity. The lockdowns mandated during the COVID-19 pandemic, which normalized working from home, also intensified isolation, and the rise of the gig economy has had the same effect, especially among the young. During the pandemic, half of Britons reported often feeling lonely, with those aged between 16 and 24 struggling the most. Loneliness is often identified as a serious public health problem, an epidemic even, that besets the elderly and young alike. It's correlated with dementia and premature death, so doctors and policymakers share the goal of reducing it. Yet measuring it proves tricky, and the subject remains largely taboo. Recently, though, there's been a glut of books exploring loneliness and solitude, and one of the ones that stands out for me is All the Lonely People by Sam Carr. He's a British psychologist and social scientist who's collected stories of individuals who feel cut off or forsaken. One that really struck me was a teenage Afghan refugee struggling to blend in at school in Somerset. Sam Carr weaves the experiences of his subjects together with his own, in particular his role as a single parent and an earlier dismal spell teaching English in Moscow, where he found himself surrounded by vulnerable colleagues. He sensitively evokes the damaging impact of bereavement, heartbreak, displacement and childhood trauma, and emphasises the stigma attached to being withdrawn and friendless. He also addresses the flaws in common means of filling the void, for instance with internet pornography, which entrenches its consumers' sense of alienation. Another book, simply entitled Solitude, explores the issue from a different perspective, talking about some of the rewards that time alone can bring. Netta Weinstein and Twivi Nguyen, two psychology professors, they begin with an account of the mythology of solitude fostered by figures such as, you guessed it, the Romantic poets, and the painter Edward Hopper, whose pictures often involve people lost in introspection, nursing a cup of coffee late at night, for instance. They then draw on laboratory work to illuminate the psychological reality of solitude. Loneliness and solitude are not the same. The author suggests, though, that what is negatively portrayed as loneliness can be positively reframed. They include practical guidance about how to tap into the restorative possibilities of being alone. In a noisy and crowded world, the opportunity for solitude is something, they say, to cultivate, a letting go, an escape from attention-grabbing stimuli, and not a shift away from others, but an intentional move toward our best possible selves. In his short book, The Triumph of the Slippers, Pascal Bruckner sees a world shrinking from sociability, relapsing into what he calls life in a bathrobe or pyjamas, authorised sloppiness. The slippers of the book's title symbolise a desire for snug seclusion. The Triumph of the Slippers concludes with the kind of checklist for keeping oppressive feelings of loneliness at bay. It asks, have we loved enough? Given enough? Lavished enough, embraced enough? My own perspective is that the short answer is no.
That's all for this episode of The Intelligence. We'll see you back here tomorrow.
Hi, this is Matt
and Sean
from Two Black Guys
with Good Credit.
From a local business to a global corporation,
partnering with Bank of America gives your operation access to exclusive digital tools, award-winning insights, and business solutions so powerful you'll make every move matter.
Visit bankofamerica.com/banking for business to learn more.
What would you like the power to do? Bank of America, N.A., copyright 2024.